Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In recent years, mass shootings in the United States have spurred heated debates about the Second Amendment and an individual's right to own a gun. Gun advocates have relied on the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms in this contentious debate. The Second Amendment consists of just one sentence, quote, "A well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." End quote. Today's guest, Michael Waldman, says in the grand sweep of American history, this sentence has never been among the most prominent constitutional provisions. In fact, for two centuries, it was largely ignored. He writes that few people understood its provisions, scholars paid it little attention, and lawyers rarely raised it in court. But over the past four decades, it has been thrust to the center of public controversy. Politicians declare themselves its strong supporters, the media bristle with reports of proposed new gun laws or new legal challenges to them. The Second Amendment has become a synonym in powerful unspoken ways for America's gun culture and a symbol of many of the deep divisions that cleave the country. So what does the Second Amendment actually say, and how does it enshrine a person's right to bear arms? How does the history of the Second Amendment shape today's gun laws and gun culture? Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, a nonpartisan law and policy institute, and author of the new book, The Second Amendment, a Biography. And he joins us from New York. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you decided to work on this book in the months after the Newtown massacre, when gun control proposals became a very hot topic and hot debate. And you say this is not a book about guns or gun control. What did you set out to do, and what did you set out to learn?
You're exactly right. I started working on it when the country was once again debating gun control and gun issues, and it was the first time that we were having this debate with the Second Amendment so much on the tips of everybody's tongues. People are often quite surprised to learn that the U.S. Supreme Court never ruled that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership until 2008. That was actually the very first time, and it had previously ruled otherwise a few times. How did that happen? I wanted to understand this story of constitutional change. It's really looking at how we look at the Constitution more than the particulars of one gun bill or another gun topic, and how this provision of the Constitution, how we understand it, has changed over time. And strikingly, the way we understand, the way any generation understands the Second Amendment, turns out not to be due to some kind of pristine constitutional text, but rather to the push and pull and the rough and tumble of public debate and public and political agitation. And that kind of has been true from the very beginning. Each generation kind of decides afresh what this provision means.
What was your understanding of the history of the Second Amendment before you started doing your research?
I wasn't all that sure. I knew that it came from a very different time, and it came out of the founding period. And I had worked as President Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter in the 1990s. So I was for background checks and things like that that we had worked on, sort of common sense gun laws. But I didn't have a totally fixed view of what the Second Amendment itself meant. So it was very striking to go back and look at the founding period. You know, Justice Scalia, when he authored the majority opinion in that 2008 Supreme Court case, it's called District of Columbia versus Heller. Mm. That was the case that found there to be an individual right. Scalia said that this was the vindication of his philosophy of originalism, the idea that the only legitimate way to understand a constitutional provision or what it means is to go and ask what the framers meant, or their generation, how they understood it. So, you know, that sort of impelled a historical look, and the book is called a biography because it's sort of, it's like a life story. And it was really interesting. I found surprises all along the way, including what the framers were focused on when they wrote the Second Amendment, which was something of a surprise to me.
Do you think that other people share your surprises and maybe misunderstanding of the Second Amendment? Because you do say that this is probably the most misunderstood amendment in the Bill of Rights.
Well, I think that there's considerable division and considerable strength of the view among, you know, the National Rifle Association or others who consider themselves gun rights advocates, that the Second Amendment means and always has meant the individual right to unlimited gun ownership, and that anything that touches on it is trampling on a sacred individual right in that way. And, you know, when you actually go back and look at the drafting of the Second Amendment, so you read it to your listeners, you know, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It turns out that those well-regulated militias were pretty important to the framers and to their understanding of what they were doing. Now, the militias were not like anything we have now. Every adult man, eventually every adult white man, was required to be in the militia their entire life, and they were required by law to own a gun and to bring it from home for their militia service. And it was their police force. They didn't have police. It was their military force. But even more important to them, it was a bulwark against tyranny. It was to ward off the threat that they saw from what they thought was about the scariest thing they could imagine, which was a standing army, which would be like what King George had, the Redcoats, a professional military force paid that could do the bidding of the king and be a source of tyranny. And when the Constitution was proposed, the book starts at Lexington and Concord, where the Minutemen were a militia, and fighting the standing army of the British. By the time the Revolution was over and we had the period of kind of near anarchy of the period before the Constitution, when the framers went off to the Constitutional Convention and wrote the Constitution, they very much wanted a stronger central government. That was what their purpose was. When they released it, there was a big debate, a roaring fight over whether to ratify the Constitution. One of the fears that people had was that this new strong central government would be able to crush those 13 state militias. And it was that fear that led directly to the enactment of the Second Amendment.
What else can you tell us about the militias and how people at that point viewed guns? Because again, men from 16 to 60 were required to join a company or train intermittently. They were expected to own and bring their own gun. They were not allowed to have a musket. They were required to. More than a right, you write, being armed was a duty. What else did you learn about that?
I'm asked, as you can guess, all the time, so what was it? Was it an individual right or was it the militias? And the answer is it was both, and it was neither. It was an individual right to fulfill the civic duty of service. And our question today would make no sense to the framers, just like their answer in some ways gives us little guidance or makes no sense. If you look at the notes James Madison took at the Constitutional Convention, if you look, with some scattered exceptions, but if you look at the ratification convention's records from the fight over whether to ratify the Constitution, if you look at the debate in the Congress over the Second Amendment as they wrote it in public, there's not a word about individual gun ownership for self-protection or hunting or the things we focus on and talk about today. And so that was really striking. On the other hand, and this is important to understand, there were plenty of guns, and Americans believed they had the right to defend themselves, especially in the home. It was a common law right handed down from England, and they believed they had a right to self-defense, including with weapons. but at the same time, that was a limited right because there were many, many gun laws. At the time of the framing, it was when the Second Amendment got passed, it was illegal to own to have a loaded weapon in your home in Boston for safety reasons. You couldn't fire a gun in the city limits of Philadelphia. There were all kinds of restrictions on who could own weapons. You had to take a loyalty oath, for example. There were registries of guns that the government had, all these kinds of things that we would regard as very intrusive. So kind of from the beginning, you had gun rights coexisting with public responsibilities and individual responsibility. And in any case, in terms of what they thought they were putting in the Constitution, it seems surprisingly focused very much on this political purpose of fighting tyranny through the militia. And then one of the other surprises is as soon as they did that, the militias went away. They kind of vanished. The whole militia system stopped being so relevant. People grew more individual. The country moved west. And people started to thinking of these things in terms of individual freedoms and responsibilities rather than what the framers were actually talking about.
Well, and it's also interesting that you point out that for the first two centuries of American history, the Second Amendment received little notice. Few people understood its provisions. Academics paid it little attention. Lawyers rarely raised it in court. Why is that?
That's all true. I mean, when the first federal gun law was proposed in the 1930s, the NRA testified for it and was asked by a member of Congress, gee, is there any constitutional provision you could think of that this might rub up against? And the NRA said, no, none that we can think of. The Second Amendment was not regarded as a central hot-button part of the Constitution the way it is now. At the time, there were guns, there were gun laws, and we kind of grappled with it as a country. We've always had more guns than other places. Mm. We grappled with it through the legislature, through the publicly and democratically accountable branches, and the courts stayed out. And in fact, multiple times the Supreme Court did not rule or ruled that the Second Amendment didn't deal with an individual right. And, you know, in 1991, the retired Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger, a rock-ribbed conservative appointed by Richard Nixon, he said that the idea that the Second Amendment recognizes an unlimited individual right to gun ownership was a, quote, fraud on the public. That's what he said. So that was kind of the conventional wisdom for a long time. And obviously that feels like ancient history now, and a lot changed.
We're speaking with Michael Waldman about his new book, The Second Amendment, A Biography. Michael is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. It's a nonpartisan law and policy institute. And Michael is out with a book not about gun control, but about the history of the Second Amendment and what it actually says and how it's evolved over time. And the Second Amendment gets so much attention now. What questions do you have about what it actually means? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you're a gun owner, what is your interpretation of the Second Amendment? And we're going to talk about gun rights and gun laws as they evolved with the country's spread west. And we'll also talk about the very important Supreme Court case that just came down recently. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. So before we talk about the history of the NRA is really fascinating, but talk a little bit about how over time gun ownership and gun rights evolved with the country's spread west. You write that frontiersmen had guns to protect themselves, to kill food, to hunt. The crowded cities of the East were less hospitable for an armed population. By the end of the 19th century, many state constitutions included language protecting the right to keep a gun at home, but authorized other kinds of gun regulation. So what did those debates sound like?
Well, you're exactly right. Over time, throughout the 1800s, the militias stopped mattering nearly as much, especially after the Civil War. And the idea of gun ownership and gun rights was very much more of a personal thing. And you saw twists and turns all throughout American history. So, for example, after the Civil War, one of the purposes of the 14th Amendment was to make sure that the former slaves who were being terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan and other white vigilantes, that they could have access to guns, that the former slaves, the freedmen as they were called, could have access to guns. Now there were gun control laws at the same time, but that was actually one of the purposes for at least some of the people who opposed the 14th Amendment. All throughout, you had this kind of interplay between gun rights and gun laws. Even in the Wild West, there's a wonderful photograph of Dodge City, the archetypal frontier shoot-'em-up town, you know. And it looks like a movie set. I mean, it's the dusty main street and the saloon doors. And it's from the photos from the 1880s, and it says, "Welcome to Dodge City, firearms prohibited." Even there was gun restrictions as well as guns. You know, when people moved into the cities in the early 20th century, the cities had different gun laws because violence was so much great. You know, you weren't shooting buffalo, but there was a great risk of violence in cities, and so you had urban gun laws that were passed starting in New York after the attempted assassination of the mayor of New York. And then when technology changed and you had prohibition and the Depression and bank robberies, think of Bonnie and Clyde or John Dillinger, then you had for the first time federal gun laws aimed at this kind of interstate problem of getaway cars, people being able to rob a bank and drive away to another state. So you can really see a lot of the kind of evolution of our attitude toward government and toward individual rights versus the collective good, looking at this kind of gun issue, although, again, over and over again, it's important to note, the courts stayed out.
Right.
Nobody thought that the Constitution, some judge ruling, was going to tell us what to do. It was always fought out in the ballot box.
Well, and it's also interesting, you write about how Franklin Roosevelt had a two-part strategy to stem what you just talked about, bank robberies and what was happening there. And then he waged a crackdown on gangsters and their guns, what his attorney general called a new deal for crime. And then there was the passage of the first federal gun legislation, the National Firearms Act of 1934, which imposed a heavy tax on the weapons used most prominently by gangsters. Machine guns and sawed-off shotguns had to be registered and couldn't be transported across state lines. And you write that in the end, the NRA, which was then a sportsman's group, actually backed this plan.
That's right. Well, actually, it was a three-part strategy, because the third part, which is relevant with our current debates over drugs today, the third part was to legalize alcohol and repeal prohibition, and so that a lot of the roots of the crime went away that way, too. Yes, the NRA played a really interesting role throughout all of this, again, in a way that would probably surprise a lot of us today. The NRA has been around for a long time. It was started after the Civil War by Union officers who were concerned about poor marksmanship by the troops. And as we think about some of the kind of anti-government or insurrectionist language quite common among NRA meetings today, the idea that it was started by Union officers alone is kind of interesting. It focused on marksmanship and training, military preparedness, and especially eventually it really spoke for hunters and sportsmen, and that was who, you know, that was when one thought of the NRA, that was really what you thought about. And it not only didn't oppose, it actually frequently supported various gun control laws. Well, what changed? What changed in a way was the 1960s. You know, we all know the social transformation of that period. Well, it turns out that the 1970s, the backlash to the 60s, was at least as significant in terms of what we're all living with in America since then. In 1977, the NRA signaled that it was going to be moving out of Washington, D.C., move its headquarters to Colorado to signal a retreat from politics, and hard to believe though that might be. And they had what's called the Revolt at Cincinnati. It was their annual meeting. 1,000 activists showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership that was was much more intense, much more doctrinaire, and that recast the organization as a constitutional crusade around the Second Amendment. So that now when you go into the headquarters of the NRA, on the wall, where once there were big letters about sportsmanship and training, now it's the Second Amendment. But you have to look closely. They've edited it. They actually cut out the first part and have just two dots. They don't even have three dots. And what the NRA did was kind of in the great sweep of American history, how you get constitutional change. They backed scholarship. They moved public opinion. They changed the elected candidates. They changed the positions of government agencies. And only then, after winning in the court of public opinion, did they go to the court of law. Only then did they go to court. And so when the Supreme Court case, you know, finally ruled in 2008, it sort of fell like a ripe apple from the tree. It wasn't all that controversial.
You write that one of your collaborators visited the NRA headquarters to look at the text on the wall, and it reads, quote, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Do you know if reporters have ever asked the heads of the NRA why they took off the militia part of the Second Amendment?
They were short of space. I don't know. You know, I originally had read this in a Mother Jones magazine article from quite a few years ago. And I thought, when I was researching the book, I said, wow, this is great. You know, what a novelistic touch. You know, this is such a perfect encapsulation of the whole thing. And then I thought, what if it isn't true? You know, that what if they fix it? That one would be pretty easy to rebut if it wasn't true, it being in the lobby of their building and all. So I sent a colleague on a reconnaissance mission. She had to go to the gift shop at the NRA headquarters and while there to take a picture to make sure that it still read that way. And so she confirmed it and came back laden with T-shirts, you know, and hats. So it was a very, very productive mission.
What else struck you about how the NRA has evolved over time? You write that from the first time of the first urban rioting in 1964 until Ronald Reagan's first year as president, membership tripled at the NRA from 600,000 to 1.9 million.
It's not a coincidence either that was the period that happened. The shift to the right, I mean the lurch to the right in a way, of the NRA starting in the late 1970s was mirrored by numerous other institutions or kind of parts of the American landscape. The evangelical churches got significantly taken over by conservative activists. The farm groups, the business lobbies, which used to be rather genteel and give to Democrats and Republicans, you know, became marked by a much more ideological approach and partisan. All of these new right institutions basically fused into a much more coherent partisan coalition. And so among other things, among the things that happened is it used to be that there were a lot of Democratic, big D Democratic supporters of the NRA. John Dingell, for example, who just recently retired from Congress, was a big NRA backer.
And Michael, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we'll talk more about how politicians also have evolved on the Second Amendment. We're talking with Michael Waldman, author of the book, The Second Amendment, A Biography. After the Newtown shootings, Michael decided to explore the history of the Second Amendment, and we'll be back after this.
This is your call on local public radio. If you have a perspective that you'd like to share with us in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, Backstory.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how people are using the web to make innovative online documentaries. We'll speak with the makers of the documentary Hollow. It's about the boom and bust of a single county in West Virginia. What is the power of web technology to enhance news and storytelling? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. It's a nonpartisan law and policy institute, and he's out with a new book called The Second Amendment, a biography. He writes that the Second Amendment, regardless of your politics, is not generally what you believe it to be. A lot of people really misunderstand the Second Amendment. For, he says, it's the most misunderstood and explosive part of the Bill of Rights. So how do you perceive the Second Amendment? What do you think it actually says? It's a very short sentence. It says, quote, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary for the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. And I use the word comma because the commas are also very important. So how do you read the Second Amendment, and how do you think it's evolved over time? What questions do you have about the, quote, right to keep and bear arms? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Tom in Berkeley. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. My understanding is at the time the amendment was passed, a major activity of the state militias was enforcing slavery. And I wondered if Professor could confirm this, what his research turned out.
Yes, that's definitely true, obviously in the South especially. It's really striking when you look at the debates in the ratification convention, for example, in Virginia, where a lot of the kind of quotes from various founding fathers on this stuff come out of. They talk with increasing degrees of explicitness about that very issue and their worry that the militia might be sent out of the state by the national government and leave them open to slave rebellion, and that this is how the federal government would bring an end to slavery. Or something like that. They were very fevered in their worries about this. In the South, of course, that was they're specially focused. In the rest of the country, it was also their police force and their military force. They thought that this is how they would protect the country. The militias stayed more robust in the South than in other parts of the country, precisely because they were enforcing the slavery system. And then the state militias turned into the Confederate Army over time when the Civil War was started.
Thank you for the question, Tom. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. And Michael, going back to the politics, you write that in 1980, the GOP platform proclaimed, quote, we believe the right of citizens to keep and bear arms must be preserved. Accordingly, we oppose federal registration of firearms, end quote. And that year, the NRA gave Reagan its first ever presidential endorsement. And then when Bill Clinton was elected, NRA membership went up another 600,000. And then the Democrats lost dearly in the 1994 election. And Speaker of the House Thomas Foley said that the NRA is the reason the Republicans control the House. So talk a little
President bit. President Clinton said that, too, because Foley lost his seat. That's right.
So talk about how that shifted the Democrats' perception of the Second Amendment and how they talked about it. You write that they just wanted to stay away from gun control because of their losses.
Well, in a way, they discovered they built a muscle memory that if you go near these issues, it's going to be politically very painful. And it's also the case that the people who lost tended to be rural Democrats, Democrats from conservative areas, often from the South. And so, among other things, they were suffering from their position or the national political party's position on gun issues. But Clinton at the time, and I was working for him, really did believe the NRA played a major, major role in taking back the Congress for the Republicans. There's some interesting a second guessing of that that suggests, you know, there were a lot of other things, including tax increase, passing, trying and failing to pass national health care, and other things like that that probably had at least as much to do with it. But the Democrats developed a bit of a muscle memory of staying away. But then it wasn't even so much that as the fusing of the NRA with the Republican Party in the late 1990s and the decade since then that led to things like George W. Bush signing legislation to immunize gun manufacturers. There were a lot of changes after those important but, you know, rather modest gun laws in the early 1990s. The momentum has been, as a political matter, overwhelmingly on the side of the NRA. For example, state laws to liberalize or loosen the restrictions on carrying weapons have moved all over the country. You had, you know, stand your ground laws like the one in Florida that we all know about from the Trayvon Martin shooting, and other laws like that that have built a very strong momentum in a lot of places for looser gun laws.
Well, and now we're seeing people taking their guns into restaurants, and people are now signing petitions asking stores like Target to prevent people from walking into a store with a gun.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that you had, for example, last year in Georgia, they passed a very lax gun law, and it's called the Carry Anywhere Law, and you can bring your gun into a bar, to church, to the Little League field. My understanding is that the first day the law went into effect, there were two guys with guns in the convenience store sort of pulled their guns out on each other like in a Western. But I wonder, too, if there's the beginnings of a real backlash on this stuff.
Hmm.
In Texas, there's the Open Carry Texas group, which are a bunch of men going around with assault weapons into fast food restaurants, Target stores, and other places like that. And it's really backfired. Even the NRA posted a web post calling it weird and counterproductive, although they then had to withdraw that. And I have to think there are mounting consumer pressure on stores not to allow these guns in. And I would suspect it's very possible that there's kind of a silent majority of women, especially, who react with a real visceral concern to the idea of people carrying around these guns. You never know if somebody... The NRA says, well, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. But if someone walks in carrying an assault weapon, you don't know if they're the bad guy or the good guy.
Well, I've also seen photos of women carrying their guns in the Target parking lot.
Yeah, but it's overwhelmingly men.
Let's talk a little bit about this 2000...
You can buy a pink gun, you know, in a store, but that's not that's
right.
The bulk of it.
Yeah, they are selling pink guns now for targeted toward women. But let's talk about the significance of the Supreme Court case in 2008, because I think you're right. I don't think that most people realize how important this was and that this decision came so late. So you write that in the end, it was neither the NRA nor the Bush administration that pressed the Supreme Court on this case. It was a small group of libertarian lawyers who believed that gun advocates were too timid. So talk a little bit about Robert Levy, this tech entrepreneur who is a fellow at the Cato Institute. 53-year-old, served as a clerk for two federal judges.
Yeah, he's a really interesting and impressive character. He's now, I believe, the chair of the Cato Institute. He was a very successful tech entrepreneur. He went to law school late in life, is a libertarian, and the Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank that addresses a lot of different kinds of things where they think the government is overreaching. And they thought that the NRA was too timid, and they actually backed a sort of a small group of lawyers who brought the case that eventually became District of Columbia versus Heller, and that was the 2008 case. And, you know, it was a kind of a classic constitutional case. They found a very sympathetic plaintiff who was a security guard who worked at a federal courts building and wanted to have his gun at home and wasn't in a dangerous neighborhood and wasn't allowed to.
And that's Dick Heller.
Dick Heller. And so, you know, the case was finally heard in 2008, and it was one of these big constitutional cases. There were dozens of friend of the court briefs. And the opinion was noteworthy. It was the first. It was the first time that the Supreme Court had ruled that it was an individual right. It was the first of these very divisive 5-4 opinions that we're so familiar with now, with the current lineup of the court. You know, before Citizens United and before the Voting Rights Act case and Hobby Lobby and so on. It was, Justice Scalia said he was following original intent. Now, I argue, but a lot of others, including a number of very prominent conservative judges, argued that the originalism that Scalia used was really not so fair the way he did it. I mean, in the 64 pages of the majority opinion, two of the 64 pages deal with the militia, which was what the entire debate was about, for example, in Congress when they wrote the Second Amendment. Interestingly, though, so, you know, it was a big deal that they ruled. It was a big deal that they said it was an individual right. It was a big deal that they relied as much as they did on the colonial and early history. But the ruling itself was narrower than it seemed. It said that, yes, there is an individual right, but all constitutional rights have limitations, and this one, too. And that, it kind of left unclear how far the right extended. It left unclear what the limitations might be, although it listed a few. But it kind of left it up to us and to the courts to sort through how to interpret what they've done and what are those limitations. So, interestingly, there are dozens and dozens of lawsuits that were brought, and overwhelmingly, the courts have upheld gun laws. Mm. They've said, yes, there's an individual right. Some of them said it enthusiastically, some said it grudgingly, but yes, there's an individual right. But society, too, has a right to protect itself. There's a powerful, compelling public and governmental interest in strong gun laws, and something like 96% of the cases have upheld the gun laws. Now, that's, you know, it ain't over yet. In particular, the question of what the Second Amendment right is about carrying weapons hasn't really been fully resolved. There's a case in California where the federal court of appeals in the Ninth Circuit, as it's called, the federal court that covers California and the western part of the United States, actually struck down a gun law dealing with carrying weapons. It's conceivable that that may get heard by a larger group of judges. It's conceivable that could go up to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has been very reluctant to take new gun cases. It's had plenty of opportunities. Now, we don't know why. Maybe it's comfortable with this emerging consensus, or maybe they just don't know how Justice Kennedy's going to rule, and he's sort of always the swing vote. So we don't really know how it's going to go, but really, overwhelmingly, there's something of a judicial consensus upholding gun laws, even under the new individual rights interpretation.
So again, the Supreme Court decision in 2008 involved a law in Washington, D.C. that was passed in 1976 barring individuals from keeping a loaded handgun at home without a trigger lock. 5-4, the justices voted to strike down that law. And you point out that the presidents who appointed those five justices were all themselves NRA members.
That's right. And that D.C. law and a Chicago law that was also struck down by another case called the McDonald case, which applied the Second Amendment to the states. You know, those were the strictest handgun laws in the country. And they were for guns in the home. And in fact, Justice Scalia wrote that the heart of the Second Amendment was the protection of hearth and home. Now, that would come as a surprise to James Madison and the others who were obsessed with these militias and the political check they were supposed to provide for a standing army. But it's also the case that as a kind of common sense question, I think most people are most comfortable with the idea that you can protect your home. To the degree that there's the court says it was following originalism, in fact it was following the evolution of public opinion, which isn't, the end of the world from my perspective. I think the way we make constitutional law in this country always is the country evolves, public opinion shifts, there's organized activism as the NRA did, or as the civil rights movement has, or as the people urging marriage equality have, or any of these other issues. That's how we make constitutional change in the United States. And I kind of think that's what happened here, as opposed to some unchanging, sacred, immutable right.
You write that John McCain applauded the Supreme Court decision, but so did Barack Obama. What did he say when this decision came down? Why did he favor it?
Thank you. Obama said that. Thank you very much. That the he supports the Second Amendment. It's kind of a catechism that lots of politicians have. I support the Second Amendment, and you could hear this sigh of relief from a lot of the politicians, because in some ways, the Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough, former congressman who has the show, on Morning Joe on MSNBC, he is a supporter of the assault weapons ban. And he said, look, the Supreme Court ruled that you can't take away everyone's guns. So don't worry about it. It makes it easier, he said, to pass strong gun control laws, because the Supreme Court has kind of drawn a line, and people who are just worried that all their guns are going to be taken away don't legitimately have that worry, even if not that was going to ever happen, but as a constitutional matter, they can protect against it. So, kind of politicians, John McCain, Obama, President Obama, they sort of all embraced it and breathed a sigh of relief. A lot of progressive scholars and activists said, in effect, well, what do you expect? The Supreme Court is very much a product of the conservative political majority. A lot of conservative judges and conservative scholars criticized the opinion because they thought it was the kind of loose constitutionalism that they had been criticizing themselves in their work. One judge from Virginia, Harvey Wilkinson, who had been considered for a Supreme Court appointment by George W. Bush, was very critical of it. He said, from his perspective, it was as bad as Roe v. Wade, which, was the worst thing you can say if you're a conservative legal scholar.
We're speaking with Michael Waldman, author of The Second Amendment, a biography. After the Newtown massacre, Michael decided to do some research to look at the history of the Second Amendment. And if you have any questions about that, how do you read the Second Amendment? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And how do you think it shapes our debate about guns, gun culture, gun control, and the massacres that we've had in the past couple of years? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm concerned that, in my opinion, too often people try to find what you might call a basic source to justify whatever their feelings are. People look to the Bible because God said this or that. People decide, oh, well, the Constitution says such and such, and the Second Amendment says such and such. I think that we should regard the people who made the Constitution as people whose feet were of clay, just the same as are our own. I was, and therefore not attach too much significance in terms of the value of what they said. Now, we do have to recognize the fact of what they said, because it has to be dealt with. I am interested in knowing what you and others feel we can do about the problem. I was struck by the aspect about the thrifty stores and whether the people could carry guns into the store or not. And I wonder if there's not an economic pressure that could be brought by, say, shopping only at stores that in those states where there is open carry, shopping at only stores that do not allow open carry.
Well, it's you make very interesting points, both about the Constitution and also about the current moment in terms of political strategy. You know, I don't think that we should, even if the Supreme Court had gotten the history right, which I don't think it did, I don't think that's the way to run a railroad. In other words, I don't think that simply trying to understand what the Constitution meant back in 1791 is the way we ever have really or should follow the Constitution. The country has evolved, and how we understand what the Constitution means has evolved, and we shouldn't pretend that we're just following the sacred words of the esteemed founders, as you know, as impressive as many of them were. As a matter of political strategy, the caller makes a really interesting point, which is, you know, the gun lobby, the gun rights movement, especially is strong in state legislatures. That's sort of where the rural vote often predominates. And among the things they have worked hard to do is to preempt the laws of cities or municipalities that want to have stronger gun laws. But there's a realm where they don't wield as much sway, which is the marketplace. You know, you've seen in the last couple of months a number of fast food chains and stores and others, you know, say they don't want guns coming in. And that's because of public pressure, often from women, but it's from public pressure of people who don't want to have the shopping experience in an armed camp. It's also, I wouldn't be surprised, too, the fear of liability, because what if there's a shooting in the store and they have not tried to keep the guns out? So I think there's a really interesting moment where some of these new avenues may prove more fruitful in the short run than legislation or the courts.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, William. Let's hear from Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest has heard of Dr. Carl T. Bogus's theory that the Second Amendment was created to placate Southern representatives who were worried that if the federal government were able to draft people to ward off foreign invasion, they, meaning the Southerners, would lose members of their militias, their slave patrols, which were used to prevent slave revolts.
So, you know, I think there's a little bit of an overstatement that I hear frequently about the militias, the slave patrols. It was definitely the case that it was one of the purposes of the militias in the South. And if you read the interesting and really illuminating debates of the ratification convention in a place like Virginia, all of which is these days available online, they're pretty clearly worried about the federal government messing with their ability to use the militias to keep things in check and to keep slavery there. What they were really worried about, actually, was that the federal government would order the militia to march out of state and leave them, in effect, unprotected from what might happen. But it wasn't, it was not quite so much an I don't think it was as much of an overtly racial thing as you might expect. Of course, it is the case that one of the reasons the gun culture stayed strong in the South, and that even the militias stayed stronger than in other places, was the need to preserve the slave system.
We're almost out of time, Michael, but were you surprised that nothing happened after Newtown when 26 people were killed, including 20 children? Parents went to Washington to lobby. I mean, a lot of people said if you can't pass anything or have something substantial happen after the killing of children, then what will it take? Were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't really surprised in the following sense. President Barack Obama and the Democrats, too, had done almost nothing on this issue for years. And we have a tendency in this country, we react in spasms. We are horrified by some public act of violence. It used to be assassinations, and now it's these mass shootings. And then we kind of take a run at doing something about it, and if it doesn't happen, we shrug our shoulders and walk away. And you know, this is not something that is going to be addressed or addressable in just a few months' time. It's a long-term debate and a long-term argument, just the same way the NRA and its allies have waged a long-term argument and a long-term debate.
Yep.
And interestingly, the Manchin-Toomey bill, which was the bipartisan bill for background checks in the Senate, it actually had the majority of the Senate. It was the filibuster and the abuse of the filibuster that prevented it from passing, not because the public was against it. The public had like 90%, something like 90% support. And the arguments that were made against it were not really so much constitutional arguments as much as like paperwork and it wouldn't work, rather than that it would be unconstitutional. So I think there's more life in that than you might think.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and author of the new book, The Second Amendment, A Biography. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are people using the web to make innovative online documentaries? On the next Your Call, we'll talk with the makers of the interactive documentary Hollow about the boom and bust of a single county in West Virginia. The viewer is asked to scroll through and click on videos and timelines to experience an in-depth portrait of a place and its people. Where are you seeing good online documentary work? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is KALW San Francisco. The BBC's World Have Your Say is next. Here at Local Public Radio, we're always looking for new ways to encourage listener support. That's why we've partnered with My Broker Donates, a new service that matches home buyers and sellers with the most effective agents in their area and then secures a part of the agent's fees for KALW. If you're planning to buy or sell a home, learn more at KALW.org/MyBrokerDonates. KALW.org/MyBrokerDonates. World Have Your Say from the BBC is next. It was recorded an hour ago for broadcast now on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio online, KALW.org. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. Three Garzons are here taking your questions.
How can I calm down my kids when they see women and children being killed every day? I don't care about myself, only the safety of my kids.
Israel and Hamas have been trading rocket fire and military strikes for a seventh day. 172 Palestinians have been killed. The UN says three quarters are civilians. Israel says it's responding to 1,000 rockets fired from Gaza. The vast majority have been intercepted. But it's led people to question what Hamas thinks it will achieve and where this will end. Well, for the next 30 minutes, you have the chance to put your questions to Palestinians living in Gaza. And with 32 million tweets sent during last night's World Cup final, many of you are discussing whether the German footballing model can be replicated, and so are we.